That just about winds things up for a fact that pretty much concludes the presentation of material for this program. Summing up very briefly, we began by taking a look at the apparently very close working a relationship between a organization David Duke headed while a student at LSU called the White Youth Alliance and the National Socialist White People's Party, which grew out of George Lincoln Rockwell's American Nazi Party. Following that, we took a look at David Duke's statement that he, while at LSU, interrupted his studies to go teach English to Laotian soldiers for the State Department. After that, we took a look at a number of interesting indications that Duke might in fact be a government agent. First of all, we took a look at a detective who had been monitoring the KKK for a couple of years. And this detective pointed to the fact that Duke says he worked in Laos, the fact that his father worked for the State Department, the fact that he was anti-Semitic and therefore might be a desirable touch point for certain anti-Semitic Arab interests in this country, and the fact that he apparently did a lot of traveling with no visible means of support. Also, this particular detective thought was very curious. And also the detective cited the fact that no other government agencies sought information on Duke, whereas they always went to him and other law enforcement officers for information on other Klan leaders. Now, Patsy Sims voiced her suspicions concerning Duke's possible status as an agent, again pointing to all the traveling he did, the fact that he always would show up in potential racial hotspots, so places where the government would want an insider, the fact that he at one point showed her a bug detector she said had been given him by a government friend, and very curiously, the fact that he not only authored an attack manual on whites, apparently, ostensibly, authored by a black militant. But perhaps the single most important indication here of Duke's possible status as a government indication is a government agent is the fact that he not only went into London against the will of the authorities, he was able to evade British customs who were trying to prevent him from entering the country. He was also able to successfully evade Scotland Yard while inside Britain, and they were trying to find him and deport him. Not an easy thing to do. After that, we took a look at the fact that David Duke's father not only was a retired military man, but also served with the State Department in Laos, or in Vietnam, building schools and hospitals for the Vietnamese government. He was an engineer. And apparently David Duke's father held views on race very similar to David Duke. And of course, we wound up with what I think one could accurately describe as a fairly chilling description of a David Duke rally in which the chanters gave all the indications of being ready, willing, and able to follow in the footsteps of Adolf Hitler. At any rate, to keep all those things in mind, we'll be back next week with the...
And that particular show, Dave, will not be back next week because that's a Hard Rain broadcast. And we are going to hear, however, another Hard Rain broadcast dealing with the same mercurial, Mr. Duke. But currently, you are live in the studio. The summing up was pretty thorough. We want to bear in mind the possibility, as we've been talking about all night tonight, about these connections, about the injection of diehard right-wing racist ideology into the American public sector and into the government, and the overlapping of clandestine political agencies and, in fact, with right-wing paramilitary groups. David Duke, a possible very good example of that, if, as it seems, he is, in fact, himself a government agent of some sort. And, again, the evidence for that as related in the last Hard Rain broadcast. And David Duke has a rather interesting agenda. If David Duke is not currently a government agent, he certainly ought to be, because as we'll find out in the next Hard Rain broadcast that we're going to air in just a moment, he certainly had thought of some things that the Reagan administration thought of, and thought of them even before they did. So that's what's coming up. Again, we're going to recite a couple of names that you will want to remember. We were just talking in the last part of the broadcast before we aired that last Hard Rain tape about David Duke and his involvement with some other Klan people, Roy Frankhauser and Don Black. Don Black's name is going to come up. David Duke's name will come up again. And Roy Frankhauser, you will remember, like David Duke, was... Roy Frankhauser was affiliated with a man named Daniel Burroughs. Daniel Burroughs affiliated with George Lincoln Rockwell, as was David Duke. George Lincoln Rockwell, his name appeared in Lee Harvey Oswald's notebook along with Daniel Burroughs's. Daniel Burroughs then died, supposedly committed suicide in Roy Frankhauser's house. So those connections between Burroughs and Duke, both connected to Rockwell, and the connections between Duke and Duke and Frankhauser, the man in whose house Burroughs died, and Don Black will be coming up. You might want to bear those sort of things in mind. And we're going to start talking about Caribbean roulette of a sort. And we're going to be airing on that subject another Hard Rain. And we all set?
Yeah, we're all set. And basically, remember the information which Nip just reviewed and which I reviewed after running that down on the Hard Rain tape just concluded. In particular, take a look now at probable, I think we can say, U.S. intelligence agent David Duke and his role in some paramilitary activities. Compare these also with what we refer to as the Cuban Fry Corps that was put together by the National Security Establishment to harass Fidel Castro before, during, and after the Bay of Pigs invasion. And compare this paramilitary milieu that we talked about as the Cuban Fry Corps with a lot of activities that are going on today. Some we're about to describe and some we'll describe later on in the broadcast.
All right, and you are again listening to Radio Free America, and we're now airing a short segment from a Hard Rain broadcast with Dave Emery.
My name is Dave Emery, and I'll be your host for the next half hour or so. During the course of that half hour, we're going to be continuing with our ongoing discussion about the Ku Klux Klan, specifically looking at some ominous indications that the Klan may be connected to the U.S. government or elements thereof. Now, in our last broadcast on the subject, we talked about a KKK leader named David Duke, last name D-U-K-E. Duke was formerly the head of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, a Klan organization based in New Orleans. Now, in our broadcast on David Duke, we took a look at some ominous indications that David Duke, in addition to being a Klan leader, may also be a U.S. government agent. And today in our broadcast, we're going to resume with our discussion of David Duke, and specifically, we're going to take a look at his role in an abortive Klan and Nazi plot to take over the Caribbean island of Dominica in 1981. Now, all of our information on this broadcast is going to be coming from a publication which covers the activities of the intelligence community very closely. That publication is called Covert Action Information Bulletin, and specifically the issue of CAIB, Covert Action Information Bulletin, that we're going to be using is number 16 from March of 1982. Okay, so CAIB number 16, March of 1982. And the article that we're going to be using almost exclusively for our broadcast is called Behind the Klan's Caribbean Coup Attempt. And it is the article here is the second of a two-part series. That article was authored by Ken Lawrence, last named Lawrence. Now, in the first part of Lawrence's article here about an attempted, an attempted Ku Klux Klan and American and Canadian Nazi attempt to take over the Caribbean nation of Dominica and basically turn it into a national socialist or fascist entity, sort of a white supremacist's paradise in the Caribbean. Basically, the first part of Ken Lawrence's discussion here talks with David Duke's role in basically getting the plot going. Now, David Duke was contacted by a mercenary leader named Michael Perdue, last name P-E-R-D-U-E. Perdue was sort of the linchpin of the whole effort in the sense that he coordinated most of the hands-on activities of this abortive coup himself. David Duke was one of the people he went to in order to get names that he could contact in order to, that is, that Perdue could contact in order to build up this particular plot. Now, initially, this Klan and Nazi group was plotting with former Grenadian Prime Minister Eric Gary, last name G-A-I-R-Y. Now, Gary was deposed in a coup in 1979 by the late Maurice Bishop in his New Jewel movement. And initially, David Duke, Michael Perdue, and the rest of the Klan and Nazi plotters were going to be joining forces with Gary in order to restore Gary to his former position as Prime Minister and ruler of Grenada. The initial, the difference in tactical approaches favored by Michael Perdue and Eric Gary led to the two of them to part ways. And when they disagreed, Michael Perdue took this incipient coup attempt and directed it against Dominica instead. Okay, but initially the target was Grenada. And keep in mind in particular here, or focus on, the role of David Duke in helping to get this whole plan together. Okay, of the recruitment process by which the Klansmen and the Nazis were grouped together in order to take over initially Grenada and eventually Dominica once the fallout between Perdue and Gary occurred. Of this, Ken Lawrence writes as follows. This once again from Behind the Klan's Caribbean Coup Attempt from Covert Action Information Bulletin number 16, March of 1982. Lawrence writes as follows. Grenada was the target. The aim was to overthrow the revolution led by the New Jewel movement and to return the ousted tyrant Eric Gehry to power. Mercenary leader Michael Perdue of Houston, Texas, began plotting his counter-revolution as soon as he read published accounts of the revolution in the spring of 1979. First, he sought out Gehry, met him in San Diego, and put forward this proposition. For a price, Perdue would overturn Maurice Bishop's government and reinstate Gehry as prime minister. Gehry agreed and told Perdue to proceed. Perdue then contacted his old friend in New Orleans, David Duke, one-time Nazi and former Grand Wizard of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, now leader of the National Association for the Advancement of White People. Duke helped by putting Perdue in touch with several of his contacts, beginning a tangled web of international fascist intrigue and high finance. One of Duke's referrals was to German-born Wolfgang W. Droege, D-R-O-E-G-E, an organizer for the KKK in Canada whose father had been a personal friend of notorious Nazi war criminal Julius Streicher, last name S-T-R-E-I-C-H-E-R. Another was Don Andrews, A-N-D-R-E-W-S, former head of the Western Guard, Canada's neo-Nazi party. A third was J.W. Kirkpatrick, a prominent attorney in Memphis, Tennessee, whose ties to Duke and the Klan had never been publicly revealed. Keep in mind Kirkpatrick here, because we're going to talk about him again later in the broadcast.
Each of these men eagerly joined the burgeoning conspiracy against the young revolution in tiny Grenada. Droege became second in command of the invasion force. Andrews recommended using the island of Dominica as a base for the attack on Grenada, and on the recommendation of his friend Arnie Poli, P-O-L-I, invested in a Dominican coffee firm to furnish cover for intelligence gathering trips and supply shipments. Kirkpatrick and an unidentified associate contributed $10,000 to help finance the plot. Perdue later said he got another $45,000 from James White, a business associate. In Toronto, they worked out a plan for the attack. It called for Gehry to accompany the landing party from Dominica and lead as Grenadian supporters. But Gehry refused. He was unwilling to land until a mercenary force had captured police headquarters in the army barracks. The argument that ensued between Perdue and Gehry ended their partnership, and Perdue began to consider other possibilities. Well, specifically, Perdue redirected this incipient Klan and Nazi coup against the island of Dominica. Initially, as we just saw, the island of Dominica was to have been used as an operational base for the planned attack upon Grenada. Now, one of the details here that Lawrence points out, which is significant for our purposes here, is the fact that Michael Perdue represented this coup attempt. He represented the incipient coup against Dominica as a U.S. government operation. This is how he represented it to the Klansmen and Nazis he recruited for his group. And obviously, all official statements concerning this venture were that Perdue's statements about U.S. government support were puffery. However, as we're going to see, there are indications that indeed the government may have had unspecified connections with this particular coup attempt, or at least with this particular group, if not for this particular attempt. At any rate, of Michael Perdue's claims that the United States government was behind this Klan and Nazi coup, Ken Lawrence writes as follows. All the recruits were gathered under false pretenses. Perdue told them he was a Vietnam veteran with combat mercenary experience in both Nicaragua and Uruguay. He claimed he had backing from the CIA and the State Department, and that former Texas Governor John Connally and U.S. Representative Ronald Paul of Houston knew what he was doing and approved of it. He told them he would be fighting communism in Dominica. Still another indication, a very hard indication, of the involvement of U.S. government forces in this particular Klan and Nazi coup attempt concerns the fact that all the Klansmen and Nazis gathered at and were recruited from a mercenary training school which is run by the Ku Klux Klan. This is not formally a Ku Klux Klan mercenary training school. The Klan itself does have a number of sort of so-called Klan and Special Forces training school, Klan Special Forces training schools, but this particular group of Klansmen and Nazis were assembling at the mercenary training school of a fellow by the name of Frank Camper, last name C-A-M-P-E-R. As it turned out, Frank Camper works for the FBI. He's an FBI informer. And in addition, it's worth noting that Camper's entire mercenary school was once busted near a nuclear power plant where they were conducting some sort of unspecified operation. At any rate, keep in mind the fact that Frank Camper is a government agent because it was at his camp that the basic recruiting was done for this particular attempted coup against Dominica, again, done by Klansmen and Nazis. Of Frank Camper's work for the U.S. government, Lawrence writes as follows. This little subsection of the article is entitled Camper's Training School and the FBI. The article begins with a short subsection here, begins with a photocopy of an ad that appeared in Soldier of Fortune. The ad reads as follows. Mercenary school, 7-day survival course, 7-day combat course. Professional cadre, affordable training in demolitions, weapons, unarmed combat. Details and applications, $1. Send it to P.O. Box 309, Dolomite, Alabama, 35061. And then Lawrence writes as follows. In our first installment, we showed that this advertisement from the March 1981 Soldier of Fortune recruited potential mercenaries for Franklin Joseph Camper's training school. Camper was aware of the Dominica plot, but declined to participate. In July, Camper's training school received considerable play in the press. Feature stories with photographs in the Washington Star, the Christian Science Monitor, the Huntsville Times, and hundreds of other papers via Associated Press. Nearly all of the free advertising for mercenary training in the U.S. was promoting Frank Camper, it seemed. But 2 weeks after the publicity blitz began, the Birmingham News and the Tampa Tribune learned that Camper was an FBI informer when the Dade County prosecutor listed him as a key witness against his erstwhile partner, Robert Lisenby, on explosives and weapon charges in Miami. Lisenby is L-I-S-E-N-B-Y. Camper's cover had been so effective that Lisenby's father wrote to Soldier of Fortune following his son's arrest to solicit information. Why would anyone with Mr. Camper be arrested? He seems like a very fine young man, and according to my son, Robert is one of his best friends. Yet right now, it seems like both face very stiff prison terms due to some informer. If anyone can shed any light on the matter, please write us. The same issue also ran a letter ridiculing Camper for the training exercise near a Florida nuclear power plant that got his entire school, unquote, arrested for trespassing. Camper wasn't happy that he'd been exposed. The reason I worked with the government is to help counter terrorism, and I can't do that if my identity is known. He also feared that the unwanted publicity would hurt his mercenary school. The Bureau has done me a great deal of harm, unquote. Once the truth was out, Camper admitted that his work for the FBI began years ago when he posed as a disgruntled Vietnam vet, unquote, in order to spy on the Alabama Black Liberation Front and the Communist Party. ABLF activists contacted by CAIB had no recollection at all of Camper, but Jim Baines, B-A-I-N-S, now secretary of the Birmingham Peace Council, remembered him well. I don't think he ever successfully infiltrated anything. As far as I know, everybody assumed he was a cop. He was such a classic. I vividly recall the first time he showed up, in his fatigues, at an anti-draft meeting at Birmingham Southern College in 1969 or 70. He advocated bombs, blowing up draft boards and things like that. Everyone thought either he was absolutely crazy or more likely a provocateur sent to destroy the anti-war movement, unquote. For a brief period, Camper's ads disappeared from Soldier of Fortune, but apparently most of his potential recruits missed the stories about his FBI connection. He now advertises his Merck school as, quote, best in the USA, unquote. The April 1982 issue of Gung Ho, another mercenary magazine in which Camper advertises, contains a long article about his training school, complete with color photos. It not only makes no mention of Camper's career as an informer, but actually implies the opposite, mentioning his two arrests in Florida and his connection with the Dominica coup plot. I knew he had been in, quote, I knew he had been in and out of controversy and jail through confrontations with the law, especially with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, unquote, wrote the author. So it would seem that Camper has successfully restored his cover, placing him in an enviable position for a government agent. Many of the most serious potential mercenaries will be attracted to him. Those the government may find useful can be recruited for the usual dirty work, while those who support causes not approved by the U.S. can be found out and stopped. Well, as mentioned, once the falling out between Perdue and Eric Gehry occurred, the target of this intended Klan and Nazi coup was switched from Grenada to the base island of Dominica. Initially, or we'll call it Dominica, a small island in the Caribbean, was to be, well, really was to serve the incipient coup group as a base of operations and as a supply base. Now, one of the interesting things concerning the abortive coup against Dominica, the plotters were arrested and never got to even put their plan into effect. They were arrested on their way to the boat that they were going to take to Dominica in order to overthrow the government there of Prime Minister Eugenia Charles. Now, one of the interesting things concerning the aftermath, I guess you could call it, of the attempted Klan or Nazi coup was that Prime Minister Charles used the attempted coup as an excuse to crack down on the left in Dominica. Now, this is an interesting thing because, of course, this coup was an attempt by ultra-rightists. And yet, nonetheless, the Prime Minister of Dominica, who, as we're going to see in just a minute, is quite close to the United States and the Reagan administration, she used this as an excuse to crack down on the left. Ken Lawrence describes this as follows. Although the plotting has been the work of discredited former officials, partly backed by outside fascists, Prime Minister Eugenia Charles has used these episodes as a pretext for a crackdown on leftists and a general escalation of political repression. The Dominica Liberation Movement says, quote, a reign of police terror, unquote, has descended upon the island since the original state of emergency was declared, including the brutal killing of a youth, John Rose Lindsay, in police detention, and the routine use of torture during interrogation. 11 other police killings have also been protested by the DLM. Newspapers from Cuba and Grenada have been banned by the government. DLM General Secretary Bill Riviere, R-I-V-I-E-R-E, protested a police rampage last June. Quote, young men and some women were punched in the head and jaw, kicked in the groin, slapped in the face. A few were gun-butted in the head and others in the face and stomach. And some were kicked in the face and head as they fell to the ground. These blows were accompanied by insults of the worst kind. One victim lost a number of teeth, and another's head and face were severely battered. Yet in the end, not a single one of them has been charged. Still more interesting is the fact that not only did this attempted right-wing coup serve Prime Minister Charles of Dominica as an excuse to crack down on the left, but in addition, the United States and Dominica then engaged in a process of arms sales whereby the small nation was armed to at least to a much greater extent than it had previously been armed. And it's worth noting that the conduits for the arms flowing to Dominica from the United States were not only Jamaica, but also the islands of Barbados, St. Vincent, and St. Lucia. And this is worth noting because those islands, along with Dominica, were they form an organization, the Organization of Eastern Caribbean States, which basically nominally provided the excuse for the Reagan administration to launch their military incursion and conquest of the island of Grenada last fall. Recall that initially, the Dominican coup attempt, as we've seen, was to be directed against Grenada. And this, once the Grenadian target was switched to Dominica and the coup was the plotters were arrested, that incipient coup, that intended coup, was used as an excuse to not only to crack down the left but to arm Dominica. And one of the interesting things is that the then armed Dominica participated in the invasion of Grenada along with the various states which served as the conduit for U.S. arms to Dominica. Again, keep all this in mind. Of the United States arming of Dominica following the abortive Klan and Nazi coup, Lawrence writes as follows. The State Department arranged a U.S. $60,000 grant, and a number of Dominican police are now undergoing training in Panama. U.S. arms and ammunition have been donated through Edward Sciaga's government in Jamaica. Dominica will join Barbados, St. Vincent, and St. Lucia in a regional Coast Guard service while negotiations are underway toward the creation of a regional army. Meanwhile, the Barbados Defense Force, beefed up and modernized by the U.S., will be on call while the Dominican police force is expanded and given a paramilitary component. A CIA source told Robert Allen Michaels, writing for Caribbean Review, that Dominica is also being defended by, quote, a Western European nation or nations, unquote, probably France or Britain. Michaels also concurs with CAIB's report of CIA involvement on behalf of Eugenia Charles and the Freedom Party in the July 1980 election. So keep in mind the reports that the CIA actually helped Prime Minister Charles to power. Keep in mind that the abortive coup directed by the Klansmen and Nazis served as an excuse not only for her to crack down on the left, but also as an excuse for her to, Prime Minister Charles to arm Dominica. Recall that Prime Minister Charles appeared at Reagan's side when he announced the invasion of Grenada. Recall also that Grenada was, as we saw, the initial target of the Dominica coup plotters. One of the most interesting things concerning the aftermath of this coup was the fact that there are various accounts of 12, 28, or 40 plotters, or financial backers of the intended Klan or Nazi coup against Dominica. Only two of them were indicted, and David Duke, who admitted his involvement in the coup right from the beginning, was not indicted. And this, of course, raises questions as to why these people weren't indicted. They broke the law. They were violating the Neutrality Act. And yet, why weren't they indicted, or in most cases, even named? And, of course, this once again suggests at least the possibility that this group of Klansmen and Nazis may have been connected with the government, perhaps, as Michael Perdue claimed, even operating on behalf of the U.S. government. While the Dominica government was friendly to the United States, and so certainly the U.S. would not want it overthrown, it is worth noting that the Klan and Nazi coup, as we've seen, was used by Prime Minister Charles to strengthen her hand, not only to eliminate the left-wing opposition, or to crack down on the left, but also to arm her regime as well. So, in speculating concerning possible motivations for U.S. involvement, U.S. government involvement with this group, the strengthening of the Charles regime in Dominica certainly has to be regarded as a possible, and I underline possible, excuse for that involvement, if that involvement was there. That the U.S. government may have been involved with this coup is indicated by some of the strange circumstances and some of the rather extraordinary legal maneuvering around the case, or a lack of legal maneuvering, I should say. Remember now that only two of the financial backers of this plot were ever indicted, and yet of the 12 mercenaries that were going to be departing for Dominica, only 10 were arrested. There appear to be two missing and as yet unnamed mercenaries. Of the strange handling of this case following the arrest of the 12 people who were going to be going, the 12 mercenaries who were going to be heading to Dominica, Ken Lawrence writes as follows. While it is clear that the U.S. had strong reasons to nip the Klan-Nazi conspiracy in the bud, what if the plotters had stuck to their original aim of overturning the Grenadian Revolution? It is possible that the U.S. and Canadian authorities might have looked the other way and permitted the attempt. Some aspects of the plot that are still being kept secret are suggestive. Why, for example, of the 12, 40, or 80 backers of the coup, depending on which report you choose to believe, were only two indicted by the grand jury? Why are the identities of the others not disclosed? Perhaps because the U.S. government has something to hide. Similarly, why was no action taken against the unidentified several others, unquote, the Los Angeles Times said refused to answer the grand jury's question. In this respect, David Duke is a significant figure. He was central to the original plot and never denied his role in it. He rebuffed the grand jury, yet no action at all was taken against him. This plus the highly suspicious fact that Duke sent Perdue to a boat captain who was an ATF informer lends some credibility to old charges leveled by Duke's Klan rivals that he's a government agent. If so, it would suggest that the U.S. looked favorably on the intentions of this ragtag band of Klansmen, Nazis, and gangsters, so long as they kept their sights set firmly on Grenada. One cannot be certain, however. It seems unlikely that a group this weak and incompetent could pose a significant military threat to the Grenadian Revolution, even if assisted by Eric Gehry's Fifth Column on the island. But a failure by such a group is likely to sharpen the alertness of Grenadians to the threat their country faces from the U.S. Prime Minister, from the U.S. Prime Minister Maurice Bishop documented the seriousness of this danger in a letter to then UN Secretary General Kurt Waldheim last August. Last August would be in August of 1981. Bishop pointed out that the U.S.-NATO military maneuver called Ocean Venture 81, the largest such exercise since World War II, had as its target a fictional group of Caribbean islands called Amber and the Amberdeens, a thinly disguised reference to Grenada and the Grenadines. The practice amphibious landing took place on the southeastern tip of the Puerto Rican island Vieques, which corresponds to an area of Grenada that actually is called Amber. Other equally obvious similarities were shown. With an attack of this magnitude being practiced, it does seem improbable that a small and inept band of mercenaries would be considered a serious U.S. option. Recall now that it is possible that this small and inept band of mercenaries may have been intended by the government as a sort of a provocateur element in order to drive or propel Prime Minister Charles of Dominica to the right. Okay, that certainly is one hypothesis that we looked at just a minute ago, and must be kept in mind, although Lawrence's point here is certainly well taken, that a small group like this would not appear to be the primary vehicle that the U.S. government would select to operate against Grenada in light of the massive military force which was used in this maneuver, and later, of course, in the actual invasion of Grenada itself. Still, though, the 1240 or 80 unnamed backers of the coup and many other curious circumstances concerning the handling or lack of handling of many of these plotters or alleged plotters is worth taking note of. One last note here, which Lawrence adds in that regard, concerns two unnamed members of the mercenary party. Initially, 12 people were to be ferried to the island of Dominica. Only 10 were arrested. Lawrence talks about this as follows. Another puzzle the U.S. hasn't answered concerns two unidentified members of the invading party. Purdue contracted with Howell. Howell was the guy who was going to run the boat to get them to Dominica. Purdue contracted with Howell to transport 12, yet only 10 were arrested. Who were the other two? One was probably Canadian clan leader Alex McWhirter, M-C-Q-U-I-R-T-E-R. He had originally been slated to lead one of the mercenary groups, but couldn't join the group in New Orleans because he was barred from the U.S. in January of 1981. What about number 12? No one has yet identified the missing mercenary. Well, it is, before summing up here, there's one last article that I'd like to read you, and it's certainly, I think, food for thought under the circumstances here. Now, in the last broadcast before this one, we took a look at a number of curious indications that David Duke might be a U.S. government agent, and certainly the failure of the fact that David Duke was not indicted here, despite the fact that he confessed his part in the intended coup against Dominica right from the beginning, is it has to be regarded, I think, as still further evidence that David Duke is a U.S. government agent. Recall that one detective who had been monitoring the Klan for some years speculated that Duke was CIA. And keep in mind that the fact that the initial target of these plotters was Grenada, and keep in mind the fact that eventually Grenada was invaded by and of course conquered by the United States. One of the mercenaries who was arrested and is still in prison in connection with the plot against Dominica is a fellow by the name of Don Black. He succeeded David Duke as Grand Wizard of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan when Duke went on to his National Association for the Advancement of White People. And the last article I'm going to read you here is a plea by David Duke for the release of Don Black, and interestingly, he takes note of the fact that the Dominican plotters were initially simply trying to do as private citizens what President Reagan was trying to do as president, and it's worth keeping in mind whether perhaps the Klan and Nazi group were actually functioning under U.S. government auspices when they attempted to invade Dominica, or perhaps when they were plotting to invade Grenada. Anyway, research credit for the following article goes to Ted Rubenstein, who is currently working, or has up until recently been working as a research assistant with Rebel Magazine, a Larry Flint publication coming out of Los Angeles. And Ted got the following article for us from the Las Vegas Sun of October 28th of 1983. It's a UPI story, Dateline New Orleans, and headlined, Ex-KKK Leader Reveals 79 Plot for Invasion. A former Ku Klux Klan leader Thursday revealed for the first time that he put some mercenaries of the deposed Prime Minister Eric Gehry in touch with some KKK members for an invasion of Grenada in 1979, but the plan was aborted in favor of a plot against neighboring Dominica. Breaking a 4-year silence on the plot, David Duke, former Grand Wizard of the KKK, discussed the events in an interview with UPI and demanded freedom from jail for a Klansman who plotted against Prime Minister Eugenia Charles of Dominica. Duke, who was questioned by the federal grand jury that indicted Don Black and 9 others, said, quote, "The Grenada invasion is a vindication of Don Black and the other valiant men who were arrested and prosecuted by overzealous federal agents for daring to fight against communism. I think it's a gross injustice that Mr. Black is imprisoned for trying to do courageously as a private citizen what President Reagan is trying to do today. Black, who took over as Grand Wizard when Duke resigned, is serving 3 years in the federal prison." One more thing I think that's worth taking a look at in connection with the attempted Dominican coup, one thing I forgot to mention just a second ago, concerns what eventually happened to J.W. Kirkpatrick. Now, Kirkpatrick was contacted by Duke to provide $10,000 to the coup plot, to the Dominican coup plot. Now, eventually, when word came out of Kirkpatrick's involvement, he committed suicide, or allegedly committed suicide, by shooting himself in the mouth. This is described by Ken Lawrence in Covert Action Information Bulletin. J.W. Kirkpatrick of Memphis, Tennessee, and an unidentified associate gave $10,000 to Purdue toward his original scheme to conquer Grenada. Kirkpatrick was a prominent attorney specializing in insurance defense, probate, corporate, family, medical malpractice, and personal injury law. He had written to David Duke, endorsing Duke's views following an appearance on television to promote the Ku Klux Klan, and the two were good friends for about 4 years. Duke sent Purdue to Kirkpatrick shortly after the original plot against Grenada was hatched. 5 days after Purdue testified in court about Kirkpatrick's $10,000 contribution, and on the very day that the assistant U.S. attorney in New Orleans announced that he planned to seek indictments against the coup's financial backers, Kirkpatrick drove to Earl, Arkansas, and committed suicide with a shotgun. His law partner Max Lucas described him as, quote, "a knight of old who preferred death to dishonor," unquote. Another colleague called him a super ultra 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 conservative. He thought the country was going to hell in a handbasket. And in a footnote to that passage I just read you, Ken Lawrence writes as follows. David Duke has questioned whether Kirkpatrick actually killed himself. "It is true that the method, a shotgun blast in the mouth, is one that Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty has described as an assassination technique used by the CIA to eliminate evidence of murder. In this case, however, a suicide note not released to the press seems to have convinced Kirkpatrick's survivors that the act was just what it seemed to be." So again, we don't know, but one of the two financial backers of this coup plot that who did come to light died under as yet ambiguous circumstances. So we really don't know. But keep in mind the fact that this whole thing may have been a U.S. government operation, and keep in mind the many U.S. government or possible U.S. government connections to it.
Yes, indeed. Do indeed bear in mind the various U.S. and possible U.S. government connections to the plot. Also bear in mind that eventually Dominica, the rearmed and fortified Dominica as a result of that coup, participated in the U.S.-led invasion of Grenada. We're going to proceed with another tape segment now, and this also is from Radio Free America 13. We're going to update David Duke's activities into the mid-1980s, where he was raising money for the Contras in a combination or in partnership with a very interesting fellow named Dr. Arnold Ochsner, who you will hear about in just a minute. Now, this, once again, tends to corroborate the information that David Duke is a government agent, quite possibly an intelligence agent of some kind. CIA comes to mind. We're going to proceed with this segment because we're going to be going all the way up to 11 this evening and we'll not have time for phone calls. So those of you who are taping, get ready to do so. 3, 2, 1, here we go.
The Contra effort in Central America, there's been a lot of discussion about so-called humanitarian aid given to the Contras. Obviously, any money given to them frees up other funds for whatever use they'd like, so it's sort of a silly notion to talk about humanitarian aid. You can give them money for food, but then they can just use the money that they were going to use for food for guns. Anyway, in light of that irony, the next piece of information that we're going to be reading from, which is published by the Resource Center at Box 4506, Albuquerque, New Mexico, and the Resource Center has entitled a document that they have listing the various various far right-wing political action groups which and or military groups which have been involved in the so-called humanitarian aid to the Contras. This article, again, from the Resource Center of Albuquerque, New Mexico, is headlined, New Right Humanitarians. And among the so-called New Right Humanitarian groups that they've discussed is a group called the Caribbean Commission at New Orleans, Louisiana. I'd like to read you something about this commission, and it's their description of the Resource Center's description of the Caribbean Commission and some of the people involved. Principals, Dr. Arnold Ochsner, O-S-C-H-N-E-R, Archbishop Hannon of New Orleans, L.A. State Representative Woody Jenkins, and Samuel Robinson. Business connections, Robinson Lumber. Formed in 1979 with the help of pro-Somoza Nicaraguans, CC aims to, that's Caribbean Commission, aims to, quote, maintain, promote, and strengthen the free enterprise system in the Western Hemisphere to prevent totalitarian infiltration. Aside from anti-communist education, CC distributes aid to Contras in Honduras. Dr. Ochsner's father wrote the white supremacist book Dispossessed Minority. David Duke, a former KKK leader and founder of the National Association of White People, works closely with CC. So David Duke is still very much involved in his activities with regard to paramilitary efforts and mercenary efforts. Of course, David Duke, probable U.S. agent and recruiter of the Dominica invasion. And worth noting here that the name Ochsner, O-C-H-S-N-E-R, O-S-C-H-N-E-R, rather, is another name that we've cropped, that we've looked at in the past, again, in connection with this paramilitary milieu that we saw combining for the Bay of Pigs in Operation 40. And in connection with that, we looked at Dr. Arnold Ochsner's father, Dr. Alton Ochsner.
Okay, I'm going to read a short segment to you from a book called Crime and Cover-Up, CIA, Mafia, and the Dallas Watergate Connection by Peter Dale Scott, copyright 1977 by Westworks Publishers in Berkeley. And they're talking here about INCA, which is the Information Council of the Americas, formed by Richard Butler. Another guy of...
Ed Butler, Richard.
Excuse me.
Yes, the other Butler. The Butler did it.
Right.
The other Butler.
The other Butler. No, Richard Butler and Ed Butler, two separate people. This Ed, although very similar in their viewpoints, this Ed Butler is a man with some very suspicious links to the Kennedy assassinations, both of them, and the Information Council of the Americas is his group. INCA's links to both Oswald and the U.S. government were considerable. INCA's president was the famous Dr. Alton Ochsner, as Dave mentioned. I'm just putting in here that is the father of the man who was involved with David Duke in this pro-Somoza, pro-anti-Sandinista group. INCA's president was the famous Dr. Alton Ochsner, a consultant to the U.S. Air Force, quote, on the medical side of subversive matters, unquote. Ochsner, a friend of the Somozas, was later identified as, quote, the first man to uncover Oswald's pro-communist activities, unquote. From unexplained first-hand impressions. Ochsner also sponsored a local journal, Latin American Report, whose editor, William G. Godet, admitted a CIA connection and also was issued the Mexican travel permit immediately preceding Oswald's. At least three of INCA's backers and Cuban employees had previously been associated with a CIA-backed Cuban Revolutionary Council at 544 Camp Street. More important, the Riley family, Eustace Riley of INCA, William Riley of the CRC Crusade, were Oswald's ostensible employers in New Orleans. Another INCA charter member, William I. Monahan, an ex-FBI agent, joined the Riley Company about the same time Oswald apparently did, and soon became the chief source of information to the FBI and Secret Service about Oswald's activities with the company.